Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Rachel Fulton Brown with us. She is she's in the faculty of history department at the University of Chicago. She's the author and editor of two books. First, the author of From Judgment to Passion, Devotion to Christ and the Virgin Mary, 800 to 1200. The co-editor of History in the Comic Mode, Medieval Communities and the Matter of Person. That's from 2007. But the main purpose to have her in today is to discuss a book of hers that just came out. It's called Mary and the Art of Prayer, the subtitle being The Hours of the Virgin in Medieval Christian Life and Thought. It also is with Columbia University Press, and it just came out?
In November last year.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having
me. Professor Brown. We're going to talk about this big, giant book, which has an extraordinary machinery of research, footnotes, archival materials, documents, discussions of translation, which version of the Bible. This is a real work of scholarship. So I salute you,
for
that. My books have always been much smaller.
I don't write short books. I seem incapable of writing a short book.
Well, you know, that makes you old fashioned.
So very old fashioned.
The first thing that I'll say is tell our readers generally, why did you write this book?
Right. So I wrote this book to solve several different levels of problem in the history of the devotion to the Virgin Mary. On the first level, I needed to write a history of this practice called the Hours of the Virgin, which was very popular in the later Middle Ages. If you've ever seen a medieval manuscript, you more than likely have seen what's called a Book of Hours. And the hours that are contained in those books are the Hours of the Virgin. Now, it's called the Hours of the Virgin because it's a prayer practice structured on the Divine Office, which is divided into the different hours of the day and then an hour at night. And the Marian office, the little office of the Virgin, or the Hours of the Virgin, matches that structure that monks and nuns would say in their choirs, in their monastic practices. The laity in the later Middle Ages became very interested in participating in that prayer life that was carried on in the monasteries, and the practice that they adopted was saying these Hours of the Virgin. So my problem in the book was to understand both what the practice meant and why it was so popular for not just the monastic devotees of Mary, but also the laity.
So roughly the years we're talking about here.
So we have witnesses. That's actually a harder question to answer than you'd think.
Yeah.
We know that the Hours of the Virgin as a practice seems to develop sometime in the 11th century. But the books of Hours that record the practice only comes some 200 years after. So it's a practice that we know existed for a long time in the monasteries and the cathedral chapters, and was gradually adopted by first aristocratic women very often, but gradually adopted by the laity over the 12th century. In the 13th century, there are women, particularly in the Low Countries, who are known as Beguines, who are living a prayer life which is often very, very closely focused on the Psalms and very closely focused in some of their practices on devotion to Mary. And it's Beguines who are hypothesized as some of the first to actually make books of hours for themselves to carry mm-hmm. on their own prayer practice. Mm-hmm. So one of the great challenges in writing the book was telling the story of the development of a devotion that we have witnesses to in sort of scattered places long before we have the sort of formal presentation of it in this manuscript form. So the manuscripts start developing. Books of Hours proper are a 13th century development, but the office itself is a practice from at least the 11th century. But there's more to the story than that.
Well, we may pursue that. But let me first ask, you talk about this devotion, and you've given us some of the facts about it, but right off the bat, I can see that you are up to something a little different from the customary historical study of these kinds of things, where you are trying to burrow in to the experience that took place when people engaged in these practices. And I'll read the first couple of sentences in the invitatory section. Devotion.
Come, we should start with the invitatory. Come, let us praise the Lord with joy. Let us joyfully sing to God our Savior.
But from Psalm 94, that is the epigraph. Yes. And then we say, this is you. Devotion requires an object, like the imagination. Devotion takes its shape and purpose from its object. Without an object, there can be no devotion, which tells us that from the start, you understand this in sort of deeper phenomenological, imaginary, experiential terms.
Yes. Yes. And that's why I say it works on several different levels. So the primary level for me as a scholar was this history of the office of the Virgin and trying to understand where it came from, how it developed, what its relationship was to the Marian liturgy, why in particular it was so structured around the Psalms. And I'd like to talk about that more. But the other layer of investigation in the work was to figure out a way for modern readers to appreciate what saying this prayer practice was actually like. And that is challenging from a number of different levels, because typically, at least since the mid-19th century, modern Christians have thought, particularly Protestants, have thought about prayer that's something that's most authentic when it's spontaneous and unscripted, which makes it very, very difficult for us to read medieval prayer practices because they're highly scripted, particularly the Hours of the Virgin. In the book, in the first chapter, I give you a little chart that lays out the different parts of the prayer practice. This is much more complicated than you would ever imagine most lay people taking up, and yet they did. And the usual way that even scholars of medieval Christianity have said, you know, these hundreds of hours of repetitive prayer couldn't have been authentic and you know, sort of
just going through the motions. Superficial.
That's always, I mean, Martin Luther had this famous phrase after he, of course, been trained in this very practice himself, that such babbling and bellowing as went on in the choirs was not real prayer, right? And what he meant was that recitation of the Psalms, that recitation of texts other than those that had come sort of to you in your spontaneous engagement with God, are not authentically touching the experience of what it is to be in the presence.
You know, I have to say, right, Rachel, I don't understand the conception that a prayer that is, let's say, scripted, that is old, that is repeated on a daily basis, is somehow inauthentic. It's not genuine, because we have prayers here in the townhouse at First Things. I'll tell the listeners here. First Things subscribers would know this started with Father Newhouse and Father Bailey, who still lives in the townhouse with other people who work at First Things. We have prayers every night, and we do some of the same prayers every night. We do, My Soul Proclaims the Greatness of the Lord, and so on. We have a litany. And it's the same
God, my Savior.
One. That's right. We have we always do a couple of the Psalms together as well. We run through them, and whenever we do the Psalms, I'm an American literature, American history person, and I keep hearing echoes of everything in American movies. It's all in the Psalms. These phrases come up over and over again, but the routine nature here, for me, has not a whisper of pejorative connotation. It's comforting. It's reassuring.
And do you know what else it's doing? Shaping your soul. This is the big argument that I'm making. So this project on Mary is a sort of subset of the problem on the effect of the Psalms on Western civilization, if you will, and on the development of Christianity. And the Marian office at its core is in fact Psalms. And so at the Marian office at its core, like the divine office, is praise of God. The Marian office is interesting because, as I said, if anyone who could read knew it, and we know that because A, if you learn to read in the later Middle Ages, the first book you would read from would be a Book of Hours. We have Books of Hours that were clearly made for children with ABCs and such in it. And what you're describing in the prayers at the townhouse, these are the texts that everyone would know by heart. And that when you're asking me about that
by heart, the metaphor should tell us something.
It's shaping your entire person. It's shaping your character. So when I say devotion requires an object, like the imagination, devotion takes its shape and purpose from its object. What the object that you hold in your imagination is going to be the thing that you can say imagination, you can say attention, right? I also give a passage from Simone Weil talking about Christian studies and how she understands, she says, quote, "The key to a Christian conception of studies is the realization that prayer consists of attention. It is the orientation of all the attention of which the soul is capable towards God. The quality of the attention counts for much in the quality of the prayer. Warmth of heart cannot make up for it. The highest part of the attention only makes contact with God mm-hmm. when prayer is intense and pure enough for such a contact to be established. But the whole attention is turned towards God."
Mm-hmm.
End quote. Mm-hmm. That understanding is what underpins the medieval practice of saying the Psalms, that you are, through the text of the Psalms, focusing your entire attention on God. And that goes back to the Desert Fathers. The Desert Fathers talk about that need to train the attention to be focused utterly on God, and that by training your attention in focused utterly on God, it's not saying quite God becomes thinkable. They worry about that, but you also are training your emotions through David's words to the experience of being wrapped in attention, the attention of God. And so that practice is what I'm trying to get at the core of, and that it was framed with Mary is very, very significant.
You know, even the etymology of the word attention bears this, tenere.
Yes.
Ad tenere, to hold to.
Right.
Right? To stay with. It's an active, it's just paying attention is not just a cognitive condition. You have to have something out there that you attach to. And that has a shaping role.
Yes.
Right? The object, this is how the object shapes you. You say at the end of that first paragraph, the lover requires a beloved to love, even as the beloved creates the lover through love. And so there is that soul making,
yes,
right, activity taking place. Now, how is it possible for you, 800 years after the fact, to engage in this imaginative reconstruction? It's the old hermeneutical problem.
It's the old hermeneutical problem.
Right? That's a different world. And your mind, your Lebenswelt just can't match up. That's the challenge, right?
That's exactly the challenge. So this book has taken a very long time to write. but in order to write it, I first had to come up with a methodology to be able to think it. And the Mellon Foundation had a fellowship that they had just started when I, right after I got tenure, and it was a fellowship for newly tenured faculty to retrain in a new discipline, and they called it a New Directions Fellowship. And so I thought at that point, well, okay, my new direction would be psychology. I was interested in much of the conversation that was going on back in 2002, 2003 on evolutionary psychology and the way it could be used to access kinds of experience in religion. So
Well, evolutionary psychology was going to explain everything.
It was going to explain everything. It was going to explain everything. See, you already know where I'm going.
Uh-huh.
So I did indeed spend a year sitting in on classes in biological psychology and social psychology, cognitive psychology, linguistic psychology. And what I came out with from that study was a sense that, the short version of it was that we think with our brains, which wasn't that much of a surprise. And the long version of it was that this was not the answer, right? It's physiologically fascinating to learn the structures of the brain and the hormonal systems and the neurological systems. It still will not explain religious experience.
Can we just hook people up and have certain experiences and then see what lights up in the brain? Doesn't that tell us everything?
No! And that is in fact the immediate problem that I was coping with.
Yeah.
Because since the 19th century, and this here, I have a whole host of sort of I blame blank, 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 blank. You've heard what I said about Martin Luther, right? That there's the problem in the Protestant tradition of not understanding the role of this monastic practice. And I think Luther actually understood. Luther had been deeply trained in it, but then he kicked away the structure that had in fact shaped him without appreciating what it was that he had been shaped by, which creates problems for, I think, the longer Christian tradition. Schleiermacher in the early 19th century, in his address to religion and its cultured despisers, is that the right title? Comes up with this argument that the way in which we can prove the existence of God or prove the sort of reality of religious understanding is by a feeling, right? This feeling of absolute dependence. And if you want the deep sort of root to the present day focus on feelings and feelings as proof, I think it goes back to Schleiermacher. It goes back to this theological effort to disassociate religion from the rational proofs that the Enlightenment had called into question, right? And so Schleiermacher comes up with this answer that's saying, well, it's that feeling that you've had. And of course, that's what Freud ultimately ridicules in his religion as an illusion, right? He says, well, you've never had this kind of oceanic feeling.
The oceanic feeling,
then there's
that wasn't his term. No, Romain Rolland, the novelist, wrote to him and said, it's that sublimity that comes over you, that oneness. And Freud simply gives it a psychoanalytical recontextualization.
Exactly.
And is that, was Freud right to do that in this regard, that this was not a sufficient explanation for, a rationalization, justification for religious faith?
It's not sufficient. Because in the what we have, it's like one of my favorite movie metaphors is from The Dark Crystal, the puppet movie from the 90s, right? And the mystery in the movie is that there are these two sets of creatures, one that seem to be light creatures and one that seem to be dark creatures, and what they are is shards of the same being, you know, these greater beings that they've been lost. And this is, so I blame the Enlightenment, or the intense emphasis on reason, which of course is what Schleiermacher was responding to. It's like, well, no, but feeling there. What you have is two parts of an older tradition that said it's both affect and intellect, in the Latin affectus et intellectus, and that or it's Anselm's faith seeking understanding, or you know, it's the sense that, and that's why the responding to love through the imagination and attention is two parts of this same tradition, that you respond out of love and then understanding becomes possible. And so Freud is, to a certain extent, right to ridicule it as simply a feeling, right? The feeling of itself is no proof. Mm-hmm. You need actually the intellectual engagement, the understanding, to respond properly to the love. And that reciprocity is what is critical to the tradition that I'm trying to describe in the Marian understanding. And you mentioned my first book, From Judgment to Passion. The focus in that book were commentaries on the Song of Songs, particularly from the 12th century, in which God is understood as the bridegroom in the poem, and Mary is understood as the bride, right? So but she's also the soul's relationship to Christ, and in a deeper way, also the community's relationship to Christ, so the churches. But it's that mystery of love and understanding, and how you move with those intentions.
Okay, so you went through your evolutionary psychology training and found, at the least, that this is an inadequate.
It's inadequate
explanation. This doesn't help me fully imagine what that 13th century aristocratic woman was doing,
right,
in her devotions.
So you know what I did next? I learned defense.
Defense. You picked up a sword.
I picked up a sword.
And you became a Christian soldier.
I did. I did indeed. And in fact, I have a blog that some people might be familiar with that is entitled Fencing Bear at Prayer.
Fencing Bear at Prayer.
At Prayer.
Is your blog.
And it's on Blogspot, but you can Google it and find it on Fencing Bear at Prayer. And I originally started it as the sort of practice behind working on the book, which was as a way of explaining some of the spiritual discipline that I'd learned from training to be a fencer.
Had you done any fencing before?
No, I started when I was an adult.
Had you done any martial arts before?
Taekwondo in college.
Okay. Well,
just a year.
A year is good. That's good. You can learn a lot.
No, and I was drawn to fencing in part by a metaphor that in the monastic tradition, indeed, it's a spiritual battle. One of the things that the monks describe their psalmody as is, truly a battle against the devil, the demons, and particularly in the period in which the Hours of the Virgin start developing as a practice, there are descriptions of monasteries are, it's a modern term, they're powerhouses of prayer, but they're places where, as the soldiers, the knights fight real enemies, the monks and nuns are just as warlike in these metaphors as the monks.
And they're consciously.
They're consciously doing this. They're consciously recognizing that they, through their recitation of the Psalms, are engaging in a kind of warfare. And I was interested in that metaphor, and I thought, well, many of the people who, particularly the monks, are engaged in this psalmody had trained themselves when they were growing up as young men as warriors. So I would think this is where, on the one hand, the neurobiology, I think, didn't take me far enough, but I also recognized to understand an embodied practice like singing the Psalms, you need to understand what the body does in this sort of discipline.
So right there is a big choice on your part, to understand these as embodied practices.
Yes.
The full person is engaged, and how the body is engaged in this is crucial.
Yes. So I took as my motto for this practice a passage from Augustine of Hippo's exposition of Psalm 34. All the psalm numbering that I give is Vulgate because we're working with the medieval tradition. And this was my inspiration for thinking about what it was I was engaged in, both as a fencer and as a scholar, in trying to understand what it is like to be embodied in prayer. You grasp my soul and topple my enemies with it. And what is our soul? A splendid weapon it may be, long, sharp, oiled, and coruscating with the light of wisdom as it is brandished. But what is this soul of ours worth? What is it capable of, unless God holds it and fights with it? Any sword, however beautifully made, lies idle if there is no warrior to take it up. So God does whatever he wishes with our soul. Since it is in his hand, it is his to use as he will.
So when we look at those monks up in the mountaintop seminary retreat over their books, or the nuns doing the rosary, this is not a form of retirement. This is not a retreat. These are not hermits. They are
on the front line.
They're on the front. They are actively engaged.
Yes.
In precisely these devotions.
Yes, and they're actively engaged in this kind of warfare. So it happens on two levels, right? So there is the sense of a spiritual warfare that we actually in this world are fighting demons and the spiritual powers. But demons, of course, in the tradition of the Desert Fathers, are not just out there; they're inside you, mm-hmm. And particularly they're your emotions. And particularly that we talk about the seven deadly sins in the Latin tradition. It comes from a list that Evagrius of Ponticus made of eight deadly thoughts, and Gregory the Great picks it up and makes it seven. But the seven deadly sins are the demons of your own sort of temptations, right? And
what eighth one was lost?
It's kind of, well, they blend. I think some of them blend. I mean, so
okay.
and the
okay.
seven deadly sins. What a very interesting. So once I posted that in the original blog format, I posted the Augustine passage as the banner, and these are one of the. Be careful what you wish for. Be careful what you pray for. I basically put that up as my prayer. Teach me. My soul is a sword. I surrender it to God. What do I learn from this? And in the course of the blogging about my practice as a fencer, worked through all seven deadly sins, because I was beset by all of them. Start with envy, end with envy, and you work through the rest of them too in the middle, right? As the And I also had a t-shirt. There's a great t-shirt that one of the fencing vendors had made of the seven deadly sins of fencing, right? And what you recognize, this is why it works both on the physical and the metaphorical level. In order to train as a fencer, you need to train first your reactions, right? You're training your fear, you're training your pride because you think you should win that bout, and basically no, you have to get in there and fence your opponent with your entire attention, with respect, with the knowledge that mistakes you make are yours and she will take advantage of them. With, it doesn't matter how long you've been fencing, you can always be beaten by somebody who just started if you're not paying proper attention. It's very humbling to train in this discipline. It also trains you. Anger is one of the great deadly sins. It's overreaction. It's losing your cool. There are rules in our tournaments that if you lose your cool, you will be kicked out, right? So you have to learn how to train yourself to that.
So all of these, all the seven sins, seven mortal sins, interfere with your capacity to be a skilled fencer.
Yes. And you get the monks
angry,
would say...
You get angry, your reactions are going to be a little off.
And it's the precision of the fencing. I mean, particularly since I started as an adult, but the people I'm fencing against, many of them were fencing when they were younger. They were fencing in college. In our community of veteran women fencers, we have Olympians, former Olympians. So, you know, this is it's very high level fencing. We're to each other's age, right? But it's, you make a mistake, she's taking advantage of you instantly, right? And a lot of the people like calling it physical chess. Much of the battle happens in your own reactions, right? To your ability to stay focused and in it. Mm-hmm. This training taught me what it takes to, I think it's a good analogy. And I will say, you asked me in the sort of hermeneutical problem, how can I, 800 years later, say that I am engaging right. in a practice that obviously I am not? Well, it's all by analogy, which is the only way we understand God in the first place anyway. We think analogically. And another of my favorite passages is from Dorothy Sayers, The Mind of the Maker, where she's talking about complaints that people have sometimes about saying our language about God is all metaphorical. And she says, well, of course it's metaphorical. That's the only yardstick we have is our own experience, our own embodiment, our own humanity. We are going to talk about God in analogies and metaphors. And I say that this is similar to our problem as historians when we're trying to understand practices like this. We cannot replicate them. Mm-hmm. We can, and Gadamer was also quite helpful. His Truth and Method was very helpful here to recognize that you are always coming to the past through certain horizons of expectation, through certain layers of your own expectation of what right. is there. And you, the what I say is the more conscious you are of the frames that you're seeing through, the greater clarity you can have about your own reflexive response to these practices.
There is an added problem, apart from this, just the general hermeneutical problem, and that has to do with something more specific about Mary in light of some of the outlooks, critics, important thinkers of the last 200 years. And before we began, you read to me a quotation about Mary.
Oh, yes.
As a very good example of a more specific thing that you had to overcome in order to reproduce the devotional experience of those times. Was it Feuerbach?
It was Feuerbach. This is a blog post on my blog.
Now, read slow.
Okay, so this is Feuerbach. Quote, the monks made a vow of chastity to God. They mortified the sexual passion in themselves, but therefore they had in heaven, in the Virgin Mary, the image of woman, an image of love. They could the more easily dispense with real women in proportion as an ideal woman was an object of love to them. The greater the importance they attached to the denial of sensuality, the greater the importance of the Heavenly Virgin for them. She was to them in the place of Christ, in the stead of God. And then I comment, do you see what Feuerbach didn't hear? Do you see how he foreshadowed almost every argument made ever since about the meaning of Mary, God's mother? about how she was in effect the monk's pinup girl because they were deprived of the company of actual women, about how whatever devotion they had to her, it must have been about sex and putting a woman in place of God. Do you understand why this argument is literally diabolical? Do you understand the pride in insisting that God takes away from man his identity, making man poor so that God, in Feuerbach's formulation, the abstraction of all human values projected onto the imaginary object, which is then imagined as acting as a subject back on man, might become rich? Do you understand how it undercuts everything in the proper relationship between the sexes, not to mention between God and man? Satan himself could not have phrased it better or more deceptively.
And you see the survival of that attitude in many places, in academia, in academic history, for example.
Yes, and in fact, in the you asked the great why of where I started working on the devotion to the Virgin Mary back when I was in college in the 1980s, was because I was reading the feminist theologians that were writing at the time. Mary Daly was, of course, very prominent among them in her gynecology and sexism, and now I can't remember what the other one is. Also Rosemary Radford Reuther I don't remember their titles. Anyway, their argument was, I mean, Daly was very, very strong about this, that the Virgin Mary was basically a rape victim. That God, at the Annunciation, asserts the patriarchal, monotheistic father figure and rapes Mary in order to incarnate himself. Daly was never that interested in the incarnation, but she was very interested in the sense that Mary was a tool of God rather than a creature who consented to her role in the mystery of salvation, right, willingly, which is the way the medieval tradition understood it.
And the point is that this is not what people thought.
Not at all.
In the year 1200, when they were doing this devotion, that's what you think. Okay, but that's not what they thought. That isn't how they conceived it. That isn't how they experienced it. They thought they were doing something different.
It was very different. And the key, so I quoted Anselm earlier, faith seeking understanding, another great passage. This comes from Anselm's prayers, his third great prayer to Mary, when he talks about the way in which Mary showed to the world its creator whom it had not seen. That what the medieval understanding of Mary was not primarily as feminine or woman, which is the emphasis it was given in the 19th century, which is why I'm pointing to it in that Feuerbach passage, that he's saying, oh, she was just this pinup girl, this projection of their desire for a woman whom they couldn't have otherwise. There are interesting elements of Mary serving Mary as the beautiful woman, but we can talk about that differently. But the primary image that I found in the medieval sources is of Mary as the creature in whom the Creator became present to the world. And I say that she showed to the world its creator whom it had not seen. She is the way to the revelation of God to humanity in the incarnation. And I think one of the most important things that my book, I hope my book, well, okay, a friend asked me last night, so what do you want to do with your book? And I said, well, save the world. And he said, what do you mean save the world? And I said, well, save the world, because understanding the vision of who Mary was in the Middle Ages is reimagining how we see the whole of creation. So saving the world is exactly what I'm trying to do with this argument, to show readers that for medieval Christians, what was astonishing and the reason that they focused so much on the moment of the incarnation was that was the instant at which God, the maker of all things, entered into the thing he had made. He entered into his creation. And that Mary is hailed throughout the Middle Ages with this great cascade of titles. And a good part of the book, it's a sort of handbook for prayer, because a good part of the book is showing you where all these titles come from and how, in fact, they're all in Scripture and how they're in Scripture for a reason. That she's hailed as the Ark of the Covenant, as the throne of wisdom, as the city of God, as the mountain, the holy mountain, as the cloud.
That list in the rosary.
Carries all of those. Why do you need so many names for Mary? And it's because you're trying to name creation and the creator of all, who entered into the creation through her. So she's, I mean, her greatest title is wisdom, because she is the mother of wisdom. And there's a great debate in the scholarship about whether Christ as Logos is more the Sophia image, or whether Mary is the Sophia image. And for medieval Christians, it's usually holding tensions and opposites, that they love doing this. It's not just intellect and affect. It's he is wisdom, and she is the mother of wisdom, and he enters into her at the incarnation. She is filled with wisdom, and therefore, and there's this wonderful meditation that I talk about from an author that we only know as Pseudo Albert the Great, who says, well, what knowledge did Mary have? What wisdom was she filled with? And she's like, well, she knew the whole of the trivium, all the arts of language. She knew the whole of the quadrivium, all the mathematical arts. She knew canon law. She knew civil law. She knew the whole matter of the sentences that was the theological textbook in the day. And to show how much we've lost in this tradition, Hilda Graf wrote a very important book in 1963-65. It was published right around Vatican II, right? And she was not favorable to this medieval understanding of Mary. She thought it was, and she was Catholic herself, but she found it ridiculous. And when she's reading Pseudo Albert and this cascade of things that he thinks Mary knows, and she says, you know, even if Mary had been alive today, she would even know, you know, like aeronautics and nuclear physics. And it's like, well, yeah, because they're trying to grasp the idea that wisdom became incarnate through her. And so if she is the seat of wisdom, the sede sapientiae, of course she's going to be filled with absolutely all knowledge, all wisdom, because how else could she contain he whom the whole world could not contain? Mm. She's heaven. She's the Holy of Holies.
Thank you, Professor Brown.